From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Washington State is the epicenter of a measles outbreak. The CDC has confirmed more than 100 cases across the country this year, and more than 50 of them in Washington. And in places like Clark County, Washington, where almost 25% of kindergartners are not fully immunized, all of a sudden there's a massive surge in vaccination requests. But why does it take an outbreak to convince some families to protect their children? And are there public policies that can change behavior before an outbreak? Well, Washington State is considering a bill that would end personal belief exemptions for vaccinations. California did exactly that in 2015, so we have a massive case study for comparison. Did it work? This hour on Point, personal belief exemptions and the public's health. And you can join us. Do you think changing the law changes attitudes and perceptions about vaccinations? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And much later this hour, we'll touch down in the Democratic Republic of Congo to take a look at how they are handling a new outbreak of the Ebola virus. But first, let's focus on measles and personal exemptions in the United States here. And we'll begin in Olympia, Washington. John Wiesman joins us. He is the Washington State Health Secretary. Secretary Wiesman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having us on.
It's great to have you. And also with Secretary Wiesman in Olympia as well is State Representative Paul Harris, Republican representing Vancouver, which is in Clark County. Representative Harris is the lead sponsor of the bill that would end personal belief exemptions in Washington State. Representative Harris, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Secretary Wiesman, let me first start with you. Can you just give us an update on the sort of the extent of the measles outbreak currently in Washington State? Has it been brought under control?
Well, thank you. Yes. So currently we have 54 cases of measles in Washington State. 53 of those are in Clark County, which is just across the river from Portland, Oregon, if folks aren't familiar with Washington State, and one of those in King County, which is where Seattle is. And we've been having, many cases starting at the end of December. And we are, in the last few days, seeing some positive signs in that the new cases that we're identifying have not had public exposures, putting other people at risk. And that is really an important piece to controlling this outbreak. Early on in the outbreak, people can be infectious 4 days before the onset of a rash and 4 days after, so they don't realize that they have measles and can be out in the public. And it's a highly contagious disease, such that if somebody's been in a room 2 hours before you were there, they had measles, and you come through and you're unvaccinated, you could actually get measles simply by walking through that space. Mm. So highly infectious. And early in the outbreak, we had a lot of public exposures, people who had been out shopping at Costco's and IKEA's, who had been at the Portland airport, who had been at churches, who had been at a stadium with the Trailblazers game. So just lots of places that people could have been exposed.
Right.
So we're seeing that sort of now coming under control.
Okay. Well, so that's good news there. But all the places they identified, I mean, those are places that in daily life people go. So it gives us a window into how quickly a select few cases can balloon into a full-blown outbreak. Now, I'm seeing here, though, that orders for a couple of types of measles vaccines in Clark County are up nearly 500%, jumping from, 530 doses in January of last year to more than 3,000 doses, according to state figures here. I mean, is the county able to cope with the demand all of a sudden?
Yes, we're absolutely able to cope with the demand. We have plenty of vaccine supply, and I think this is one of those lessons about this is a totally preventable disease. And when people actually see the disease and understand that there's a vaccine to prevent this, they want it. We have seen the vaccines in the last couple of weeks. We usually give about 200 vaccines a week in Clark County about this time of the year, and that has gone over to 1,000 vaccines for the MMR, for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So clearly, when people see a threat, they want to protect themselves.
Right.
We just want them to do it much earlier than during an outbreak.
Okay, so Secretary Wiesman, hang on here for just a second, because let me turn back to Representative Paul Harris. Representative Harris, this is your home territory, Clark County. And first of all, before we get to the bill that you're proposing, I'm seeing this number that I just can't stop thinking about, that only 76.5% of kindergartners in Clark County have had all of their required immunizations. That was for the 2017-2018 school year. It seems to be an astonishingly low number. Do you have a sense as to why the vaccination rates are so low in Clark County?
Well, I think part of it is we really don't know. So part of the bill that I'll do will amend that we're going to have the districts. If you follow, when kids come to school, a lot of kids aren't prepared. The parents aren't, so they don't have all the paperwork ready. So about 7% of those people, we actually don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't filled out. We don't know. They haven't filed the exemption. They just haven't turned in their paperwork. And then the others, I think really it's a lot of misinformation regarding vaccines. As we're seeing now, a lot of people are getting vaccinated. And I think you can go to the internet. It's a great tool, but it gives a lot of information sometimes that's not accurate. And so we have a lot of people that I believe are misinformed, that don't really understand. And, you know, our society, we're so fortunate that these diseases, because the vast majority of us are vaccinated, these things have gone out of our lives and we don't know what they're really like. But boy, I tell you, we don't want these diseases back in our lives.
Yeah. So give us a little bit of detail what's being proposed there in Olympia regarding personal belief exemptions. So what's the status of the law now vis-a-vis what parents can do, and what are you seeking to change?
So the way the law is written now, you have three exemptions. You have a personal exemption, you have a religious exemption, and you have a medical exemption. And so what this legislation does is if you philosophically or personally don't want to get vaccinated, it eliminates that exemption. That's what the law does. It's that simple. So if you philosophically or personally just think, yeah, you know what, I don't think I want to go down that road. I don't want to have a vaccine. And right now you could file that and you would not have to have your children vaccinated. So this would take away that personal exemption.
And for religious exemptions, is that folded under a personal exemption?
It's not. It's a separate exemption.
I see.
And so is the medical exemption. So there's three exemptions. This would get rid of one of the three.
Okay. I guess I'm curious, and I don't know if we know the numbers, of the three, are the personal belief exemptions the ones that people most often use?
The vast majority.
I see.
The vast majority, yes.
Okay.
One-tenth of 1% are medical, and I think the religious is just slightly higher than that, but by far the personal exemption is the largest, yes.
Okay, and so this would eliminate those exemptions entirely, because we're going to talk about what they did in California in a few minutes, but
mm-hmm.
but there, just briefly to mention, they eliminated personal belief exemptions for anyone who wants to send their children to school, public or private. So is there also a link in the Washington proposal for school attendance?
There is.
Okay, so tell us more about that.
So it would go into the public and to the private schools that you would need to be vaccinated, and it would get rid of that personal exemption.
Okay, so tell me, what have you been hearing then from your constituents about this proposal?
Oh, I've been hearing lots of positive, and I've been hearing lots of negative. But it's really interesting. Remember, the vast majority of the people are vaccinated. That's it. So if we take your figure, 75% of the kids right now are getting vaccinated. So that would tell you that 75% of the people agree with vaccinations. I would say that there's another 10% that probably haven't done, between 7 and 10% that haven't done their paperwork. So that puts us up to 85% of the people basically believe in vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 15% out there that are not sure. So the vast majority agree. I'm hearing a lot, of course, from a screaming minority that are very concerned about it, as I am very concerned. But I'm very concerned about those kids who have literally compromised immune systems, cancer kids, kids who have had serious medical treatments, whose immune systems are depleted, and they're going to school, and they're with someone that might not have been vaccinated who's been exposed. And these kids, so I have got literally hundreds of kids have been exposed who have been out of school now for a month, and they still can't go back because they're concerned about what's still going on. So there's a lot of freedom talk in this issue, and it's fascinating of who has more freedom. And I gotta say, I'm siding on the side of the student who really doesn't have a choice in this. the kid who has had maybe a heart transplant, or the kid who's in a cancer treatment. These are the children who have absolutely no choice. And yet you have a choice. You can have a choice to be vaccinated or not. And if you choose not to be vaccinated, I have a phenomenal school, online school that you can attend that is really, it's world class. You don't need to come to school, and you can go online, and it's a phenomenal program.
Yeah. So let me turn back to Secretary Wiesmann here, the Washington State Secretary of Health. So Secretary Wiesmann, if I remember correctly, herd immunity, in order to achieve herd immunity, as it's called, you need vaccination rates to be north of 95%. Is that right?
That's correct. For the measles vaccine, measles disease, which is so contagious, you need about 95% of folks to be vaccinated to essentially not allow these outbreaks to take hold in a community. And we call that either herd immunity, as you said, or community immunity, which is really about the community, all of us protecting each other.
Yeah. So do you see the removal of personal belief exemptions as an effective way to raise those vaccination rates above that herd immunity level? Or does it also need to come with additional education, other public outreach efforts? Because we are talking about some deeply held personal beliefs by, you know, it might be a small minority of parents, but as Representative Harris said, you know, they're a vocal and passionate minority.
Yes, absolutely. I think there are three things that we need to do. One is certainly the education. Folks need to have information about vaccines. We want parents to get their questions answered, and we want them engaging with their healthcare provider to make sure that they're understanding all the both benefits and what might be some common side effects from the vaccine. But as Representative Harris also said, we have two other groups, those who simply haven't turned in their paperwork, and we need to work with our school systems on that and really turn that around. It's unacceptable that 8% of our students, we just simply don't know their vaccination status. And there are various reasons for that.
Yeah.
And then the personal exemption, you know, 3.7% of our students have personal exemption. And those three things together, I think, will get us where we want to be.
Well, Secretary Wiesmann and Representative Harris, stand by here for a moment. We have to take a quick break. We're talking about a move in Washington State to eliminate entirely personal belief exemptions regarding vaccinations in an attempt to raise vaccination rates so outbreaks like the measles outbreak that is happening there right now are a thing of the past. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about efforts in Washington State to end personal belief exemptions around vaccinations as the state of Washington is in the throes of a measles outbreak there. We're joined today by Washington State Secretary of Health John Wiesmann. He's with us from Olympia, Washington. And State Representative Paul Harris joins us as well. He's the Republican State Representative from Vancouver, Washington, and sponsor of the bill that would eliminate these personal belief exemptions. So let's hear a little bit from neighboring Oregon, where they're also seeing measles cases as well. And I should mention, by the way, that Washington and Oregon are among some 17 states that allow non-medical exemptions for vaccination requirements for schools, or school entry, I should say, and that's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. So here's Dr. Don Nolte of Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, talking to the Associated Press last month about where the outbreak in Oregon is mainly occurring.
So at this time, we are experiencing a measles outbreak, which is really defined as a cluster of cases. And right now, it's been, I think, at least 35 cases, all linked to one community. And that community has a very low vaccination rate.
Well, this measles outbreak in the Pacific Northwest is forcing some people to change their daily routines. Last month, for example, Jocelyn Smith in Washington State, she told the Associated Press that she is not taking her 11-month-old son out in public until he gets his measles vaccine at age one.
I know that it is such a polarizing topic and I know that they feel very strongly about their stance. But I think when it comes down to it, you have to defer to medical professionals and epidemiologists that are recommending the vaccine. I mean, it's so maddening that it's something that is 100% preventable and is still prevalent.
That's Mom Jocelyn Smith in Washington State. Secretary Wiesman, let me just turn to you quickly because I wanted to check with you. I mean, Jocelyn Smith is obviously taking the outbreak very seriously, but she's not taking her child into any public place for the next month or so. Not clear whether or not her child has a medical reason for that, but is that an extreme response or an appropriate response to the measles outbreak?
I would say it's not an extreme response. What we know is the risk right now in Clark County is elevated for getting measles. We've had many, many, many of these public exposure places, and so it is logical that parents would want to do whatever they can to protect their kids, and especially kids who are at an age where they're not yet sort of getting the vaccine. Again, the message here, I think, is this is all preventable. This outbreak did not need to happen if we had had folks who simply got the vaccine.
I see. Okay. So as we mentioned earlier in the show, there is a massive case study on the effectiveness of changing these personal belief exemptions rules. And it's just south of Oregon and Washington in the state of California, where they made this change in 2015. So joining us now from Stanford, California, is Michelle Mello, professor of law and health research and policy at Stanford University. She's researched the legal and ethical implications of vaccine exemptions for many years. Professor Mello, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So first of all, it's been a little over 3 years now since California first made this change on personal exemption rules. Was it effective? Did vaccination rates go up?
It has been effective. In the first year after the law went into effect, we saw our rates of full vaccination go from 92.9% to 95.6%. They were just south of that last year. So to harken back to Dr. Wiesman's comments about herd immunity, that put us over the bar for measles.
Okay. And did the rates go up, especially in the communities that had been seeing lower overall vaccination rates?
Yes. The worse the vaccination rates were in the community at baseline, the bigger the increase they saw.
Okay. So this is really interesting, right? Because it seems to imply that a simple change in the law saying you can't take your kid to public or private school unless you get fully vaccinated, that was all it was take to change parental behavior on something that seemed so – a belief that's so deeply held.
Well, the thing is, we don't know how deeply held it is among the entire population of folks who get exemptions. We know there are some who have very deeply rooted beliefs that are going to be very difficult to dislodge no matter how much science is thrown at them. There may be others who are on the fence, who are not sure, or simply haven't gotten around to it. And so a law like this that just makes it harder to opt out may get enough of those who don't feel super strongly about it that actually we can let a few of those who do go and still get to where we need to be in terms of population health.
I see. Okay. So we keep talking about this sort of middle group that just hasn't done it yet but may not feel strongly about it. Okay. So good. But that in terms of public health, that's an effective solution then. But I'm seeing now, though, that there's this new crop of stories of parents paying for medical exemptions.
Right. So there have been a couple of studies by Dr. Saad Omer and his team who found that local health departments were reporting sort of willing providers who were marketing the availability of medical exemptions on the internet. And local health departments reporting that in many cases, the medical exemptions in California seem a little bit suspect in terms of their merit. And also because the physicians who are signing these tend to be a small number of providers over and over, likely not the child's treating physician. This can all be traced back to aspects of the California law, which, like the Washington bill, allows a certification by any healthcare practitioner that the child has a medical reason not to get the vaccine that doesn't specify, like Mississippi or West Virginia does, that the physician has to be in a certain specialty or the child's regular treating physician. So in California, we've seen anesthesiologists writing these medical exemptions, surgeons, folks who are likely either family friends or have been found on the internet.
Wow. So people who are determined, they're going to find a way. Is the California state legislature considering some proposals on how to deal with this new problem?
I'm not aware that they are, but this research was just published a few months ago, and it does create a moment of opportunity for regulations to come in and fill in some of the gaps in the California legislation. And I think it also suggests some lessons for other states who are looking to learn from California's example, that there are some fine tunes that they can do to legislation to prevent some of the enforcement issues we've seen here in California.
Okay. I'm looking at some reporting from KQED in California from just last week that they're saying that some legislators are debating proposals such as that they want a proposal that's modeled on an existing California state requirement for veterinarians, that if a veterinarian seeks to exempt a sick dog from rabies vaccination, they've got to obtain approval from health officials. So sort of use a human analog of that regarding medical exemptions for vaccinations. Would that work?
Well, that would certainly make it much more difficult. I do think there's a fine balance here to be struck between getting the most kids vaccinated that we possibly can and maintaining public trust in the enterprise of vaccination.
Yes.
I think personally that laws that keep parents in partnerships with their regular treating pediatricians to evaluate the risks and benefits of vaccines are most likely to get us there. So I would favor a law that requires the treating pediatrician to certify. That gets parents into their trusted physician's office to talk about vaccinations. Frankly, it's very likely to convince a number of hesitant parents that they should go ahead. And it doesn't bring the state into this relationship at quite such an early stage.
Okay, so I want to explore that more with you in just a moment, Professor Mello. But let me turn back to Representative Paul Harris in Olympia, Washington. Representative Harris, what do you think about what Professor Mello is saying about sort of what might be best practices in achieving the herd immunity that we want, but also not making the state too much of a presence in people's lives?
What I love being about a legislator is that you always learn something. And so I took notes of, I really like the idea of the treating physician being the person that the family goes to, who is the ultimate person that hopefully they have trust in, that will give them the sound counsel and guidance. I find it fascinating that's the person that sometimes they don't trust, or that's why I find it odd that many people aren't getting vaccinated. The majority of them have a physician. Hopefully they go to them, they trust them. So I think what Dr. Mello said was very accurate, and I will look at that and to maybe tighten up my belt even more.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Representative Harris and Secretary Wiesman and Professor Mello, hang on here for just a second because I want to get at least a couple of calls here while I can. So let's go to Edith, who's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Edith, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment has to do about history. We know what happens when we do not vaccinate the population. We've had cholera, smallpox, and even polio. So that's my comment. Why should there be such a dialogue when we know what the end results can be? And that children are minors. They're under the care of their parents. So informing parents, educating parents, so that we don't go down this road again.
Mm-hmm.
That's my comment. Thank you.
Well, Edith, thank you so much for your call. Professor Mello, let me turn back to you. You just heard Edith ask about informing and educating parents better as well. I mean, have we seen efforts that work on that regard?
I think there's a lot of evidence that counseling by pediatricians does work,
yeah.
Particularly when pediatricians follow best practices, which include not beginning with the assumption or position that the parent is scientifically illiterate or not acting in the child's best interests, but really approaching this from a place of trying to share medical information, as they do for all other treating decisions, with a parent who may be uninformed or may be overwhelmed by the range and types of different information that is available on the internet, as you talked about earlier. Because as with any other issue, we all know we go on the internet and it's hard to sort fact from fiction. Pediatricians are in a really unique position to help parents do that. And again, their job is not, they are not the state, they are not public health officials. They have one job and one job only, and that's to be the parent's partner in protecting a child's health.
Right. You know, I mean, pediatricians are in a tough spot here because there's so much they have to go over with parents and their children at all of those, especially those visits in the early years, that I imagine that it seems like, I mean, it's their duty, but kind of some heavy lifting to ask them in addition to say, spend extra minutes, and we're talking a matter of minutes here, to have exactly that kind of conversation that you're talking about, rather than just saying, you need to get your children vaccinated.
You're right. And it may be that what needs to happen, particularly in the context of these outbreaks, is more meetings where the community can come and talk with a panel of pediatricians outside of an office visit and spend as long as they need to spend, whether that's minutes or hours, getting their questions answered.
Yeah. Well, Secretary Wiesman, let me turn back to you here. You're looking at this view from the level of public health. What are your thoughts or your responses to the focus that we have now on the conversations that happen in pediatricians' offices?
I think that makes total sense. They're the trusted provider of the parents' children, and that's really a great place to have the conversation, and we encourage that. I think we also have to look at where people get their information, and certainly healthcare provider is one of those, but where do we talk to other people and say, hey, what about this? Parents talk to parents as well. And so part of our approach in Washington State has been trying to educate parents and have them actually bring up the conversation with their fellow parents to educate them and let them know why they've made the choice to have their child vaccinated. And then, of course, I think the other place people get their information, internet, obviously, and that can be tricky in terms of how do you trust what information. And I think you have to go to websites that are trusted websites like the Centers for Disease Control or WebMD or Mayo Clinic, those places that really, you know, people understand are trusted sources of information. And, of course, popular magazines that we might read, whether it's Women's Day or whatever.
Yeah.
So we've got to, I think, take this whole approach.
Let's go to Wanda, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Wanda, you're on the air.
Hi. The speaker, I think the name Wiesman.
Oh, Secretary Wiesman, yes.
Wiesman was mentioning kids whose immune systems are compromised. So at risk of seeming... at risk of seeming to be the screening minority here, maybe the emphasis needs to be taken off of legislation on vaccines and put into the energy needs to go into genuine research on the human immune system. I would encourage parents to keep learning, keep studying, trust their own knowledge, their own research, their own intuition on the subject. And a last point, I think is a good one. If profit and money were removed from the production and the development and the implementation of vaccines, then would there be need to have a mandatory vaccine law?
So Wanda, actually, can I just something here? You were referring to things that Representative Harris was saying, and I'll turn to him in a moment. But when you said parents should trust their own intuition, I mean, look, I'm a parent too, and a lot of parenting is based on intuition. But here's a question: we're talking now about a question of science, though. I mean, the scientific body of evidence of the extreme efficacy of vaccines is many decades long. So are you suggesting that parents should trust their intuition over the entire world of medical science on this issue?
It's not all purely intuition, of course. I would question what you mean by science. Who's science? There's too much happening in this country with corporate science, okay?
Okay.
Too much money in it.
Right. Well, Wanda, thank you for your call. Representative Harris, since she was referring to things that you said, let me turn back to you. I think one of the things that, of the many things, but one of the things that Wanda's getting at is she just doesn't see legislation as the answer. She sees it as intrusive on parental rights. Your response to that?
I'd completely disagree. So I think we heard what happened in California when legislation was done. More people got vaccinated. I'd kind of like to address, though, and this might be more controversial, but this tends to be me at times. So Merck, one of the manufacturers of the vaccine, if Merck looked at all the things that they made, vaccines actually is one of the least profitable items for them. I always find this a fascinating discussion that truly the pharmaceuticals are the big ugly guy in the room. They're making millions and millions of dollars off of this. To be quite frank, if Merck really wanted to make a lot of money, the last thing that they would make would be a vaccine, because they're making far more money on tons of other things that they're manufacturing. So this isn't a big brother. This is truly about community safety. The first caller, the Edith, had called in and talked mm-hmm. about, do we really want polio again? Do we want these diseases? This is the greatest invention in medical history. Has still been the vaccine and what it has done for our community. Let's not lose sight of that. And once again, sit down with your chosen primary care physician, talk to them about vaccinations, become well informed on the issue, and make a decision for your family.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting arguments at times, but I don't know that those are them.
Well, Representative Harris and Secretary Wiesman and Professor Mello, hang on here for a second. It's time for another quick break. We'll come right back. We're talking about efforts in Washington State to eliminate the public belief exemption around vaccinations. And they did that in California in 2015 and what the effects were. We saw vaccination rates there rise. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about efforts in Washington State to eliminate the personal belief exemption around vaccinations. And we're joined today by Representative Paul Harris. He is the Republican state representative from Vancouver, Washington. He's the lead sponsor of the bill we're talking about today. Washington State Secretary of Health John Wiesman is also with us. And in Stanford, California, Professor Michelle Mello joins us. She's a professor of law and health research and policy at Stanford University, because in 2015, California did eliminate the personal belief exemptions around vaccinations. And so it's a terrific case study on what changed after such a law was passed. So let's go right back to the phones, though, and go to Joe, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all? Hey, I really don't have much to say other than I'm going to get right to the point. You know, these people that think they shouldn't have their kids vaccinated need to quit drinking so much of their own Kool-Aid. They're not nearly as smart as they think they are. The medical history behind vaccinations has been well proven. You know, and they need to quit reading stuff on the Internet. That's about the worst source of information you can get. And, you know, there is another way to do this if these people don't want to cooperate. You send a local deputy sheriff down to their house. You take the social service system with them. Take their kids out and throw these people in jail.
Okay.
You know, they don't get to pick and choose what laws they want to abide by. I don't. They shouldn't either.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you for your call. So, Michelle Mello, let me turn back to you on this, because I have heard a not insignificant number of people saying we can't just eliminate exemptions. I mean, what Joe said is what some folks call for, like even criminalizing not getting your children vaccinated. You've studied this. Does that seem to be a step too far?
I think it is. I don't disagree with the thrust of what he's saying, which is that there's no scientific basis for this decision, and therefore it's hard to see it as a decision that is child protective. In fact, it's one that's child endangering. That I agree with. The question is the remedy and what the role of the law is here. Again, I think the law has to be a backstop when our primary systems of getting people to make good health decisions fail. And when the law does intervene, it should be in the least restrictive way that will achieve the public health goal. I think California's example has shown that there is a role for law to play on this issue, but it doesn't need to be as draconian as the caller suggests in order to work.
Right, because, I mean, just to explore the draconian end of things for one more minute here, that, in my mind, raises the question, like, where do you draw the line? There are You know, I always think about the flu vaccine. Very, very important because flu also kills a lot of people every year. But there's no mandatory requirement for it. No one is suggesting that adults who don't get vaccinated with flu vaccine be sent to prison. Do you see what I'm saying? So, like, where do you draw the line in terms of how much legislation to enact to protect the public health?
Sure. You know, there is always the slippery slope argument because there are lots of decisions that we parents make that others may disagree with vehemently and that probably do put our children at risk. And there are certainly some who fear that if we kind of let the camel's nose in the tent, in a sense, allowing the state to force parents on this issue, where is it going to stop? You know, what if you, for example, have an obese child? Is a parent criminally responsible for not maintaining that child's health? I don't worry about that so much. Mm-hmm. I do trust in the legislative process to ferret out instances of coercive action that are not warranted for the most part.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of other sort of legislative tools as well, right? I mean, again, I'm seeing here, this is from KQED's reporting about ideas currently under discussion in California right now about creating new review processes and oversight that would be managed by local public health officials, or giving those same public health officials authority to review the actual exemptions that come to them, or even collecting data on who the physicians are that are granting the exemptions now. Those seem to be far less heavy-handed, but perhaps effective means to more closely monitor the rate and who's getting exemptions in this day and age. What do you think?
Right. You know, the great thing about doing law on a state-by-state basis is it gives us natural experiments in policy, and then once we see how they go, we can fine-tune. And with California's law, there are a couple of fine-tunes that we could really use here and that can be beneficial to other states. One is, don't put schools in charge of verifying and following up on vaccination status. It puts them in an adversarial position with respect to families who they're trying to serve and partner mm-hmm. with. Having health departments take that role is smart. The second is, be specific about how the law's mandates apply to unusual situations like kids who have individualized education programs or who are homeschooled but come into campus for certain activities. In California, local health departments had to figure that out themselves, and there was a lot of variation from district to district. And third, don't leave the door open for willing providers to write medical exemptions of dubious merit.
Right. Okay. So really interesting lessons learned there in California. Secretary Wiesman in Olympia, Washington, let me turn back to you. You know, something that's emerging in the course of this conversation is how to strike the best and most effective balance between effective legislation to really tackle a major problem, but also maintaining the public's trust overall. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on where and how to strike that balance.
Yeah, I think that's something we're all trying to achieve here, actually. And that balance of science is important, and making sure that parents have the opportunity to get their questions answered. So I think that's something we all support. We're interested in the ideas that California is sharing. Both Representative Harris and I are taking notes here on those, to see how we can make sure that we're being as effective as we can.
Okay. Well, Representative Harris, let me turn back to you then. Can you just give us a sense as to where in the legislative process your proposal is right now? Do you feel positive or confident about its future?
Oh, absolutely. We're doing very well. We will hear that, I believe. So we had a public hearing in our committee on the bill. We will, I believe, vote on the bill either today. It'll be voted on this week in committee. Mm-hmm. We will vote on that bill. Then it will go into our beautiful system. It will go into the rules. I will pull it out of rules. I sit on the rules committee. And then we will vote it on the House floor. And then we will send it over to the Senate.
Okay.
So I'm very confident the bill is doing very well.
Okay. Well, interesting. So Professor Mello, last question or last couple of questions for you. Oregon and Washington are one of 17 remaining, are there two of 17 remaining states that allow for personal belief exemptions around vaccinations? If Washington's bill passes, we have that one plus California's. Do you think, is there some momentum behind eliminating these exemptions in the remaining states?
I think there is. You know, Every time we have an outbreak, this issue comes up again, and there have been several now, not just measles, but also pertussis or whooping cough. Then research gets trotted out. We see once again that tighter state laws are associated with lower rates of non-medical vaccinations exemptions, and that is in turn associated with lower rates of vaccine preventable illness, and the momentum builds. And then in periods in between outbreaks, that's a time when rational deliberation about these laws can take place outside some of the very strong feelings that occur on both sides. So I think, you know, again, it's still relatively early in this transition process, but this is an area of law that has seen a lot of flux over time. It used to be the case prior to around 2003 that states were actually a lot tougher about personal belief exemptions. There was a liberalization trend in the mid-2000s, and we've seen the result of that now with these outbreaks, and it's time for the pendulum to start swinging back.
So finally, what would you say is the most important lesson learned then from California's experience so far?
I think that thoughtful lawmaking in a time of outbreak can really produce an effective law that strikes a good balance between our public health objectives and protecting children who indeed are too medically fragile to be vaccinated.
Well, Professor Michelle Mello, Professor of Law and Health Research Policy at Stanford University, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Paul Harris, State Representative representing Clark County, Vancouver, Washington specifically. Representative Harris, many thanks for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest.
And Washington State Secretary of Health, Secretary John Wiesman, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And folks, we know that people have a lot of thoughts about vaccinations and effective ways to protect the public health. So let us know at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, for the last couple minutes of the show, we wanted to turn our attention to an issue of global health and another outbreak, this one specifically in the Democratic Republic of Congo, because the country is experiencing its most severe Ebola outbreak in more than 40 years. More than 500 people have died thus far, making it the second largest outbreak on record. Now, you'll remember that 11,000 people were killed in the massive West African Ebola outbreak that went between 2014 to 2016. The Congolese health ministry now is saying that Ebola vaccinations have saved thousands of lives, but violent conflict and misperceptions are complicating efforts to control the virus. So joining us now from Bunia in the Ituri province of the Democratic Republic of Congo is Alex Wade. He's an emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. Alex Wade, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, of course, you're a long ways away, so there's a slight delay in the line. But, Alex, if you could first tell us, what is Doctors Without Borders seeing right now about the extent of the Ebola outbreak?
So, unfortunately, currently the situation remains very concerning. Since the beginning of the outbreak, the geographical spread has been very hard to predict. There's been an epicenter which, since the beginning, has moved slightly to the south, but with other small pockets of confirmed cases anywhere in the region. Every time this happens, all of the actors involved have to mobilize immense amounts of resources to really start the activities of the response from scratch, including gaining the trust of the local population in health promotion activities and building the centers where treatment occurs, which are highly specialized. Additionally, as you mentioned, since the very beginning, there's been a huge difficulty in accessing all of the areas where there are confirmed cases due to the security situation. North Kivu has been a province with instability for many, many years. So getting access to the communities to do the work at the community level with them, but also to follow up with contacts of other confirmed cases has been very, very difficult for the actors involved.
So let me just jump in here because just
additionally, as you mentioned,
Alex, I'm so sorry to interrupt because the delay on the line is going to make this a little difficult. But to jump in here and clarify, so the outbreak I'm seeing has been going on for several months now, almost 6 months. But as you're saying, there's infrastructure challenges in getting clinics set up in places that need the assistance to control the Ebola outbreak. There's informational challenges as well? Are people getting wrong information about, I don't know, the availability of an Ebola vaccine or its efficacy? Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. That is certainly one of the biggest challenges is the perception of the local populations of the response. There are a myriad of rumors that circulate around the response, saying that it's a conspiracy to harvest organs or to kill the local population. So one of the most important elements of the response is working closely with the communities to educate them on what Ebola is, on who the actors are and what we're doing, to be very transparent in what we're doing so that we gain the trust of the local population, that they themselves become ambassadors to the response and very engaged in the response.
Okay, so how is that going? Is that working?
There's certainly been successes, but I would say globally it remains one of the highest priorities for all of the actors in the response to really focus on. There remain areas of active transmission where people still either believe Ebola is not real or believe that it's a conspiracy with more insidious reasons there behind it. And so it continues to complicate the response to this day, both in accessing the areas in order to bring treatment or bring people to the centers where they can be treated, but additionally in what's called the contact follow-up, in which you try to contact or find all of the contacts of confirmed cases who could have become in contact with the virus and could be falling sick in the next few days or weeks. And so then you follow up with them on a daily basis. If they get sick, you can invite them into the centers for treatment. And many of the people do not wish to come forward because they continue to have mistrust for the response and question what the response is really about.
Right. Alex Wade, tell us a little bit more about how the instability in Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is complicating efforts to control this Ebola outbreak. Because, of course, it is a country that's seen enormous challenges and war for years now. I'm seeing reports here that there are concerns that the Ebola outbreak could potentially cross borders. Is that still a fear?
It's certainly a fear. It's certainly a worst-case scenario. I mean, at this point, the biggest fear would be if the epidemic were to reach Goma, which is a city in the DRC, but a very large city of over 1 million people. And in that case, it could quite easily cross over to, for example, in Rwanda, which is just next door. So that certainly remains a concern. With regards to how the security is impacting the response, there are a high number of active armed groups in the area. There have been attacks on cities where there are members of the Ebola response present, which sometimes has resulted in not being able to leave the city and go into the communities to work. Sometimes activities have had to be suspended. Sometimes movement between different areas where there's activities going on has to be suspended, and so it becomes difficult even to coordinate within ourselves to transport materials. So it has had an impact for all the actors on several levels.
Okay, and final question, and we have about 30 seconds left, Alex. This vaccine that's being offered, it's an experimental vaccine, if I understand this correctly. Is it proving effective?
So it would be premature for me to say because it's currently in its study phase. So the data is being collected by the WHO and by the Ministry of Health. What I can say is that we are all very, very hopeful that it will prove to be efficient and that it will save lives and it will change the dynamics of Ebola responses in the future to make it a slightly more manageable disease. So we're all very hopeful that it will go in that way. I can't really position myself on its efficiency because the study is ongoing, but we do hope to see very positive things from it, yes.
Well, Alex Wade, Emergency Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders, speaking to us from Bunia in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.